All right, so this chapter is a little unusual compared to the other chapters because all the other chapters are just devoted to an organ system, right? This one is, what's it called? Water, electrolyte, and acid-base balance. So this isn't about one particular organ system. It's about homeostasis of those three things, water, electrolytes, and acid-base. Well, that's not the job of just one system. There's actually many different systems that at least somehow contribute to this. Now, a lot, chiefly involved is the urinary system. It's not the only system by any stretch, though. But anyway, we're going to continue talking about things that happen in the kidney, so it's a little bit of a continuation from the last chapter. Some of the organ systems we haven't even talked about yet that are involved, like the digestive system, for instance, is involved. We haven't even gotten to that chapter yet. But anyway, I think this is the only chapter that isn't just the whatever system. Well, why is it that these three things are important to homeostatically control? What's the big deal about water? Yes, we do need it. All organisms need water. And that's simply because life is really just homeostasis, right? Any organism's life, the reason it's living is because it's undergoing chemical reactions. Metabolism is the combination of all the chemical reactions occurring in an organism, in the cells of those of however many cells it has. Well, that chemistry that's happening in life is aqueous solution chemistry specifically, right? Those chemical reactions are occurring in solution, and specifically that solution has as its solvent water. So all the thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions that are occurring in cells wouldn't happen if it weren't happening in a watery environment. So water molecules are really most of the molecules of your body. And, you know, without water, you don't have life, which is exactly why when we search for evidence of life extraterrestrially, what that really amounts to is looking elsewhere for water, evidence of water. Right, we can see other planets and things, and what we look for is whether they actually have water there, because without water, we might as well stop looking for life. What about the next thing on the list? Electrolytes. What are electrolytes?
Ions.
Yeah, strictly speaking, the electrolytes are the salts that those ions make, but we usually use the word to refer to ions directly. Electrolytes are so called because electrolytes in solution allow water to conduct electricity. But ions are the charged particles that we collectively call electrolytes. Why are they important, though? Back to the question. Various reasons. There's not just one answer. They're important. Some electrolytes are important as cofactors, for instance. What are cofactors? Any idea what a cofactor is? Not actually a substrate. A cofactor is an inorganic particle that needs to be hooked on to an enzyme to make it an active enzyme. So many of your enzymes wouldn't work if you didn't have cofactors hooked onto them. And many cofactors are metallic ions. So potassium, for instance, is a cofactor for certain enzymes. That's one major reason. If you don't have your enzymes working, obviously you're not metabolizing, you're not alive. So it's important for that reason. Electrolytes also, though, are really important in the operation of what two types of tissue? Nervous tissue and what else? Muscle tissue. Now, you could say all tissue, but particularly muscle and nervous tissue, because what do they have in common? Well, all cells have sodium potassium pumps, and that's why I say you could say this for all tissues, not just muscular. But what is true of muscle tissue and nervous tissue that's not true of the other two types of tissue you're made of? They do form synapses, but what I'm... Yeah, and what do we call tissues that are able to produce action potentials? Excitable. They are excitable tissues, nervous tissue and muscle tissue. Excitability, which is the ability to produce and propagate action potentials, relies on movement around of ions. What is an action potential, actually? What's another name for potential? Here. What do we measure it in? What units? Volts, right. An action potential or any membrane potential, which includes all cells have a membrane potential, is a voltage. Well, that voltage, which is a separation of electrical charge from one place to another, namely in this case across the membrane, across the thickness of the membrane, that the reason that there is charge there is because the ions are carrying those charge. So if you unevenly distribute charged particles on one side of the membrane versus the other, what you are creating is a voltage. And so that is the basis for how your entire nervous system works and your muscular system. Smooth muscle as well, which isn't actually part of your muscular system. Muscular system includes your skeletal muscle. But cardiac muscles and smooth muscle also operate on this basis. So you wouldn't have a brain, a spinal cord working, a peripheral nervous system, a heart, or any of your alimentary canal working, plus other things, if it weren't for ions. You wouldn't be much of a person without all those things. The other reasons is, well, another important thing about ions is that their distribution affects water, because water moves by osmosis based on solute concentrations, right, on either side of membranes. So that's another importance of them in terms of overall balance of water. And then acid-base balance, why is that important? Everyone hear that? Everyone hear these whispers that are over here in the corner? Confidently declare what you're saying. What did you say? pH balance is just another name for acid-base balance. Well, my question is, why is it important? Well, okay, yeah, it's just kind of another way of saying it. Yes, it's true that you don't want your fluids to become too basic or too acidic. But why? What's the big deal if that happens? What do you mean by screw up the proteins? They can denature if it's too alkaline as well. Right. Any given protein has its shape based on several factors. You know, the primary reason for a protein having its shape and therefore its function is whatever the sequence of amino acids that make up that polypeptide is. They interact with each other and make it fold up into a certain shape. But the environment in which this folding has happened matters as well. And at different pHs, proteins take on different shapes. Well, you have all kinds of proteins in your body, but a huge fraction of the overall proteins in your body are working as enzymes. If you ignore the effect on all the other proteins, which happens as well, so you really shouldn't ignore it, but even if you do ignore it and just focus only on your enzymes, changing the shapes of your enzymes by changing pH will kill you. Right? Because the metabolism that I say is your life, those thousands of chemical reactions, almost all of them are happening with the help of a catalyst, which is what the enzymes are. So they won't happen, those reactions won't happen without the catalyst's help. The catalyst has to have the right shape for it to work as a catalyst. So definitely you want to homeostatically control acid base as well. In the first slide, we are really concentrating on water here. And what you see in this cartoon is that the body is really made up of multiple compartments that are watery. So there is a dichotomy, first of all. You can think of it in terms of two categories of fluid. There is intracellular fluid and extracellular fluid, right? The basis there is whether that fluid is inside a cell or not. So all of the trillions of cells in your body, each of those has intracellular fluid in it. If you add up all of that cytosol, which is the fluid part of the cytoplasm, then that is the intracellular fluid compartment. Yes, it's in separate little cells, but we call it one compartment because it has that in common, the fact that it's all inside a cell somewhere. Everything else fluid-wise is extracellular. But that extracellular fluid is actually compartmentalized so that we can subdivide extracellular fluid. One extracellular fluid compartment is the plasma of the blood. Now, why don't I just say blood? Because blood has cells in it, and the fluid inside those cells, that's part of the intracellular compartment. So the red blood cells, which are most of your blood cells, and the white blood cells, those are cells just like cells that don't move around in your body as much. So they contribute to the intracellular compartment. But the plasma is extracellular matrix, right? And therefore, obviously, extracellular. That's one of the extracellular fluid compartments. Another is lymph. Lymph is not inside cells, right? And still another is interstitial fluid. Now, interstitial fluid is just the fluid that is outside of cells, between cells. And so that's what this book is calling tissue fluid. Okay, the interstitium, when we use that word, refers to all the fluid that's outside and between the cells. The arrows here indicate that water moves freely between these. Now, I say freely, even though you're taught, and it's true, that water shouldn't very easily go through plasma membranes. Why shouldn't it very easily go through plasma membranes? Because it's polar, right? The things that are easily able to go through the phospholipid bilayer of a plasma membrane are small and nonpolar, right? Those things don't mind being right by those tails that make up the phospholipid bilayer. So water, you would think, shouldn't cross. It is fairly small molecule, so that doesn't really keep it from crossing, but the polarity does. Well, being polar is only partially being charged, so it's not as bad a case as it is for an ion. That allows some to sneak through. And also just the fact that the overwhelming majority of particles are water means that many, many actually pass through. Not as many as it would be if water were nonpolar. Then it would just be a rush right through. But still, even though we say that water doesn't easily pass through the phospholipid bilayer, enough of it does that osmosis is occurring all the time through plasma membranes. Now, there's a way that we can speed that process up, by the way. How can we hasten the amount of osmosis that occurs? Aquaporins, exactly, which we've talked about in the last chapter, and we'll talk more about in this chapter. But notice what's going on here. The woman is drinking. Now, that water is really still outside of her body while it's in the alimentary canal. But water gets absorbed. Some of it actually gets absorbed right in the mouth. But absorption really, the major absorption begins in the stomach and the small intestines, more so later. That water now is officially inside the body. It comes in through the digestive tract, but what compartment does it immediately enter? As it's being absorbed, which compartment does that water immediately enter? Think about the lining of your gut. What lines your gut? The endothelium, right? But what is it made up of? Don't overthink this question. What makes up any endothelium? Cells. So what's the answer? The intracellular compartment, right? That water, by passing from outside of your body in the lumen of the gut, passes through the plasma membranes of that endothelial lining of your gut. So it temporarily gets put into those cells, right? But then it can pass from the intracellular fluid into the interstitium. The other side, it can leave the other side of that cell and now be part of the interstitium. And from the interstitium, or extracellular fluid compartment, that particular subdivision of the extracellular compartment, it can be put into the bloodstream by osmosis, right? How does it do that? Well, it doesn't actually go directly from the interstitium to the bloodstream. Why is that? Well, it can, a certain amount, because it can go in between cells of the endothelium making up the vessel, but it also can actually go through those cells, right, by osmosis. The cells of the capillaries, of the capillary lining, are themselves cells, of course. So it can go from the cell lining the gut to the interstitium, into the cell lining the capillary, and then into the blood. But it can also just bypass going through those capillary cells, like I said. Anyway, you can make it into the bloodstream. Well, the bloodstream, you already know from the previous lymphatic system chapter, is leaky, right? So it's going to, because of blood pressure, it's going to leak at capillaries. Some of that liquid gets reclaimed by the bloodstream, most of it, in fact. Some of it doesn't, which is one of the major reasons you need the lymphatic system. And so water ends up in the lymph. But once it's in the lymph, it doesn't stay there, of course, right? It gets moved back to the bloodstream. Where at, specifically? Where does the lymph empty into the blood circulation? Subclavian what? Veins. Why veins? That's not actually why, though. It is true that they're going back to the heart, but it would get back to the heart no matter where you dumped it. Why not dump it into subclavian arteries? Lower pressure in the veins, right. It'll take the liquid. All right, so those are the compartments. Let's go to 2 and talk about balancing water. To actually have true water balance means that you need to have the amount of water taken in equal the amount of water being removed from the body in a day. And we can see that there are various kinds of gains of water and various kinds of losses of water. So metabolic water is listed first, and these are just averages, of course. These numbers can be drastically different depending on what the body is doing. But what is metabolic water? Metabolic water is water that's produced by metabolism, correct? And, actually there are 2 sources for this. You mentioned one of them. Metabolic water, though, is water that's not taken into the body by drinking. So it's not water to begin with. It becomes water chemically. It's created as water in your body. And so there's 2 major sources of that. You mentioned one, which is aerobic respiration, right? Aerobic respiration has what as its inputs? Sugar, like glucose, and what else do you need for aerobic respiration? Oxygen. And then those become what on the output side? Water and carbon dioxide, right? The carbon dioxide comes from dismantling the carbon skeleton of whatever that fuel molecule is, like glucose. But the water comes from reducing oxygen, like you say. What does reducing mean? Adding electrons to it. So the process of cellular respiration adds not only electrons, but actually protons as well. Electrons and protons together are hydrogen atoms. When you add hydrogens to oxygen that you breathe, that makes water in your body. That's not water that you drank. So that's one major source of, I mean, that's the major source of metabolic water. The other source, though, anyone know? Well, it comes from synthesis of compounds. When we synthesize, what are we doing? We're building molecules, right? Building bigger molecules out of smaller ones. What kind of reactions cause that? They are anabolic, true. That's the part of metabolism that I'm talking about. Anabolic means building things up, so synthesizing. But chemically speaking, what kind of reactions allow us to hook things together to make bigger things? Well, what kind of reactions do the opposite? What kind of reactions split things? Hydrolysis. What's the opposite of a hydrolysis reaction? Condensation reaction. And so in a condensation reaction, you take two smaller things, hook them together, right? But in that process, you're taking an OH off of one thing and an H off the other thing so that they can be hooked together. An OH and an H together make water. So water gets created in the process of synthesizing compounds. That's the other major source of metabolic water. Food, of course, is not entirely dry. Food has a lot of water in it because food is organisms. You're eating the bodies of other organisms, which of course have water in them. So that's a major source of food, I mean of water intake as well. But of course you also drink. And drinking is, as you see by the numbers, the major source of water intake daily. Now what about the losses? Well, you lose some in the feces, even though you have a large intestine whose major job it is to dry out the feces as much as possible. I shouldn't say as much as possible, as much as practicable, because if you dried the feces out too much, then it's hard to eliminate the feces. But that's the major job. The absorption of the nutrients was done previously. Well, I know we haven't gotten to this chapter yet, but the small intestine does the absorption of the nutrients. The large intestine dries it out as much as is good to reclaim that water, but you still lose water fecally. You also have expired losses. We talked about this in the respiratory system chapter, right? Every time you exhale, you are losing water, especially if you breathe through your mouth, like in this picture. Why is that? Why would it be reduced if you exhale through your nose? Well, so is the air that's coming through your nose, though. Right. The turbinates, or what's another name for the turbinates? The nasal conchae. Remember the nasal conchae introduced turbulence? Well, that moistens the air coming in, but it reverses the process on the way out. It causes the water to condense back out of the air onto the surface of the epithelium lining the nasal conchae. And that saves you water. But it's not a 100% saving, so every time you breathe out. Now, it comes close to being 100% savings in certain organisms, like a kangaroo rat, for instance, doesn't have to drink, ever. It gets water from its food, but it also makes metabolic water. Of course, all these things apply to a kangaroo rat. On the other hand, it loses almost no water on the way out because it has very extensive, elaborate nasal turbinates. Anyway, there's nothing you can do about that. You have to breathe, right? Cutaneous transpiration. Cutaneous means what? Of the skin, of the surface, which is mostly skin of your body. Transpiration here refers not to the water that you lose by sweating. Water is also lost directly through the cells of the skin. So transpiration here is not secreted water in the form of sweat. This is also something that you have nothing, there's no way around this, it just happens. And notice that That includes 400 milliliters of water per day. So it adds up. Sweat, on the other hand, is controlled, but it also represents a water loss. Now, you need to sweat to stay alive, because otherwise your body would overheat. But that's a trade-off, right? You have to spend water, which you need, in order to cool yourself down, which you also need. And then the overwhelming majority of the water lost is in urine. Now, that the urine component of this water loss is also the one that is the most adjustable in your body. Most of these losses you can't do anything about. They're obligatory water losses. To stay alive, you have to lose the water via those routes. But the urine, the amount that you lose in the urine can vary tremendously, like we've already talked about in the other chapters. The idea here, hydrostatically, which is just one, you know, it's the water component of homeostasis, is hydrostasis. The idea here is to make the kidneys work in such a way that the urine component of the losses makes the overall loss exactly equal the overall intake, so that you are in water balance. Now to three. Well, here we're looking at the mechanisms at play when dehydration occurs. So this guy in the Sonoran Desert, no shirt on, is not only getting skin cancer, the more urgent problem is that he's dehydrated. He can't find that oasis. And so dehydration is at the top. That's already assumed. It doesn't have to be for being out in the desert, of course. But you just don't drink. You're going to get dehydrated, definitely, because you have these obligatory losses. So eventually you'll be in water deficit. Well, what does that do? Well, increased blood osmolarity. Why does that make sense? Why would dehydration make your ion concentration higher? Everyone hear that? Why?
The reactions aren't breaking down?
No.
That's
better than not saying anything. That's good for your participation points. Why does osmolarity go up when you lose water? Everyone hear that? Why? What did you say? Why does it make it more concentrated? Because what is concentration? Concentration is the amount of solute per volume of solution, right? Well, water is the solvent, so it contributes to that overall volume. If you reduce the volume but keep the salt level the same, it becomes more salty, right? You evaporate salt water by boiling it for long enough, you get saltier water. Because the same amount of salt is there, but you're dividing by a smaller volume. Therefore, the quotient gets bigger. So it's not that blood osmolarity is increasing because there's more solutes there. Same amount of solutes, but less water. Reduced blood pressure, why does that make sense? Under dehydration. Why is that a direct result of dehydration? Right, there's just less blood. If you're losing water, you're losing the major component of blood, which is water. So the overall blood volume is less. If you have less volume in that closed system of tubing, then you don't have as much pressure on the walls of that tubing. Okay, well, how are these dealt with? Increased blood osmolarity, notice, can stimulate hypothalamic osmoreceptors. Osmoreceptors are cells that are able to sense a change in osmolarity or solute concentration. And so if they are stimulated because the blood osmolarity has increased by virtue of losing solvent, losing water, then that's going to cause a couple things to happen. Reduced salivation, that's an appropriate response, right? Reduced salivation doesn't do anything to gain you any water, notice, but at least does reduce the amount, additional amount that you're losing by salivating more. saliva is mostly water. And you know, and I'm sure you've noticed this when you've not drunk in a while, you're out working in the heat, can feel your saliva getting really sticky and thick because the water component of that saliva is now missing and it's mostly mucus. Notice also, though, that stimulation of the osmoreceptors causes your brain to create the sensation of thirst, which is basically just telling you to get on the ball and drink. That's important because without that, we would drink even less than we do. And actually, humans, compared to most mammals, don't really have a very keen sense of thirst. By the time we get thirsty, usually we should have already drunk. But it's there as a mechanism to force us to. The reason there's a question mark on dry mouth, which is caused by reduced salivation, is because they're not really sure whether the dry mouth directly actually leads to sense of thirst. But anyway, that's what's happening with the osmoreceptors. Meanwhile, with the reduced blood pressure, well, a reduced blood pressure because of the loss of the volume in water also, of course, is going to directly reduce salivation simply because the less watery your fluid is, the less water there is available to put in the saliva, even if you wanted to put it into the saliva. So that's not even a feedback response. That's just simply a physical response. But the other part here, branch from reduced blood pressure, we already have talked about, right? Renin. What is renin? It is an enzyme released from kidneys in response to decreased blood pressure, which you get if you lose water by dehydration. So renin does what? Cleaves angiotensinogen. Where does that come from? The liver. So angiotensinogen is what? What do we call that? It's an example of what? Pre-pro hormone. It's a pre-pro hormone. So it has two changes it has to go through in order to become an active hormone. Renin does the first of those changes. It cleaves off some amino acids. That makes it into what? Yes, a pro-hormone, but specifically angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 travels where? Well, everywhere the blood goes, but yes, the lungs is where it will end up eventually. And what do the lungs do? They produce what? Right, angiotensin-converting enzyme, ACE, and that converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2 by cleaving off some more amino acids. Then you have the final active hormone, angiotensin, which, notice, stimulates hypothalamic osmoreceptors. Angiotensin 2 is that active one, and hypothalamic osmoreceptors being stimulated by angiotensin 2 is going to cause the same things that happen when they're stimulated because of increase in osmolarity. It's the same osmoreceptors, they're just being stimulated in two different ways. So that's why these things converge on this effect of causing a sensation of thirst, which hopefully will spur you into drinking. Now, it might spur you into wanting to drink, but there has to be water available as well. Well, if you actually go through with drinking, that's going to cool and moisten the mouth, if it's not boiling water. And there's evidence that just that cooling that happens in the mouth will feed back and reduce the sensation of thirst. Which is why, you know, just sucking on an ice cube, for instance, can kind of feel like you're chugging water. Kind of reduces that desire to drink. It's not actually bringing in more water if you do that, so it's not really a reliable mechanism, but there is evidence that just the cooling part and the moistening does that. More importantly, though, it rehydrates the blood because that fluid's coming into the body via the digestive tract like we talked about in slide one. Eventually makes it into the blood. But if you really take a big drink of water, which you would if you were dehydrated, truly dehydrated, that's going to immediately stretch the stomach because you're taking in more liquid than can be brought in by osmosis. So it stretches the stomach, and distension of the stomach also sends a signal that will inhibit you from drinking further. The blood actually becoming hydrated, that's the true signal that you've solved the problem homeostatically, right? Not until the blood gets actually hydrated can the body rest assured that you've taken in enough blood. I mean, enough water. And in that case, you have long-term inhibition of thirst until you lose some more, of course. Four. Well, here's another feedback diagram. This time we're looking at what happens in terms of the renal response. So we still have dehydration at the top. That's the original error signal. Now, dehydration means that you're going to have a lower than normal water content. That's why the downward arrow by H2O. And as we've already talked about, an abnormally high sodium concentration. Now, sodium is just one of the osmolytes or electrolytes, but it is by far the most important ion when it comes to balancing water. And that's because, as we've talked about, water follows sodium ions by osmosis. So wherever the sodium ions are, that's where the water is going to flow. Anyway, dehydration will be manifested as a low water content, a high sodium concentration. Since these compartments share water by osmosis, you don't talk about dehydration being in just one of these compartments, right? If you're dehydrated, if you lose water from the interstitium, that means you're going to lose water from the blood as well, because water is going to flow from the blood to the interstitium to make up for that loss. So dehydration removes water from the blood, even though indirectly. And therefore, the osmolarity is going to go up. Well, the osmoreceptors get stimulated, like we've already talked about, but an effect that we didn't see in the previous slide of these osmoreceptors being stimulated is that they will send a message to the posterior pituitary, otherwise known as what? The neurohypophysis, good. The neurohypophysis is just an extension of the brain, right? So it has axon terminals in its end, and it's responsible for what two hormones? ADH and oxytocin. Oxytocin is not involved here, but ADH is. So it stimulates the particular neurons that release ADH to release that ADH into the blood. What does ADH stand for? Antidiuretic hormone. And it therefore opposes diuresis, which is what? Diuresis is the production of a large volume of dilute urine. The reason that urine would be dilute is that it contains a lot of water, right? And that also is why it would have a large volume. Well, antidiuresis prevents that, which is exactly what you want to happen when you're low on water in your body fluids. You don't want to put it into the urine when you can't afford to lose anymore. So we've talked about what happens to the kidney in response to ADH. ADH has receptors in the distal convoluted tubule, but mostly the collecting duct. And what is the effect of that ADH when it binds to the receptors on the kidney tubule, specifically the collecting duct? It does what? Right. It sends what? Aquaporins. So these aquaporins that are embedded in these little vesicles inside the cell get embedded into the plasma membrane. That's a short-term response. But prolonged dehydration, if you can't find the water, that keeps the ADH level high. And in response to prolonged ADH, what happens at the kidneys? Now, they're still, meanwhile, embedding as many aquaporins as they already have built in the plasma membranes. By the way, what does that do? When you have the aquaporins in the plasma membranes of the collecting tube endothelium, what does that cause? reabsorption of water, which means puts it back into the interstitium, and therefore it can make its way into the blood again, takes it out of the urine. But back to the question, when you have prolonged ADH secretion, which tells the body, it's been a while since I've drunk, what does that cause at the kidney level? Production of new aquaporins. So the aquaporins that already exist, those are the ones that are stored in the vesicle and can operate immediately because it doesn't take long for that vesicle to coalesce with the plasma membrane. But if that doesn't do the trick and you still have ADH high level, that will tell those cells, go back to the DNA, transcribe the gene for aquaporin, make a bunch more copies, and get those embedded in the plasma membrane as well so that you can save as much water as possible. Once again, though, that does not do anything to increase your water level, right? All this does is keep you from losing even more. So the true negative feedback of ADH is that in addition to what it does to the kidney, it can lead in the brain to the sense of thirst. And assuming that there is water available, that will cause you to actually take water in. Then you finally are negating the error. You have to take water in to negate the error of there being too little water. Okay, so you increase water absorption at the kidneys because of ADH, but what that means is that your urine volume is going to be drastically reduced, and you probably have noticed this if you work outside for a long time. You're doing a lot of sweating, losing a lot of water. Well, you might go for many hours without having to micturate because you don't have very much urine volume being produced. But notice it also increases the ratio of sodium to water in the urine. Increasing that ratio means that the water level is going down in the urine, right? When you decrease the denominator in a ratio, ratio is just a fraction. When you decrease the denominator, that makes the quotient big. That's why it says it increases the ratio. Not really because you're increasing sodium, but because you're decreasing water. So ADH is important in this overall scheme because while it's true that whatever sodium does, water follows, ADH is a way to adjust the water without actually messing with the sodium. All right? Five now. Well, here we're looking at sweating. And actually the same, well, no, this is specifically for sweating. Sweating is controllable. You sweat more certain times than others, of course. And why are you sweating to begin with? Because you're hot. I knew someone would say that. But I mean, why is sweating an appropriate response to being hot? Well, why does it cool you, though? Why does evaporation cool you? Yes, it is true that sweating allows for evaporative cooling. Exactly like an evaporative cooler in your house if you happen to have one. Because it pulls what out? Not exactly. Not really a surface tension thing. I mean, it's true that evaporation removes water molecules from the liquid phase. But why does that cool an organism? Have I talked about this in here already? Am I confusing this with cell bio? Why? Yeah, it does remove heat. Whenever you remove material, you remove heat because material contains heat. But the reason that evaporation is so important as a cooling mechanism is, well, requires understanding what temperature is. Temperature and heat are not the same thing, right? Hopefully you know that already. Temperature is an example of an intensive property, meaning the intensity matters, whereas heat is an extensive property. It's called an extensive property because the extent of the material matters. How much you have matters. And so to illustrate the difference, think about the ocean. The ocean has a certain temperature, right? If you take a little cup of ocean water out of the ocean, that water has exactly the same temperature, at least immediately it does. Same exact temperature of than the ocean does. But that cup of water has a hell of a lot less heat than the ocean, because the heat is the energy of the molecules moving. More molecules, the more heat. All right? So that's the difference there. But what is temperature? How do we define temperature for any given substance? Yeah, temperature is, well, what about the motion? Heat is the energy of the motion. What is temperature, though? The speed, right. Temperature relates to the average speed of the particles in whatever sample you're measuring. Now, there are trillions and trillions of individual particles making up that sample, and they're all moving in their own direction at their own speed, so they're not all moving at the same speed. But if you were able to somehow get in there and measure the speed of all the individuals and then divide by the number of individual particles, you would have an average speed. That's what we call temperature. All right? Now, imagine a body of water evaporating. Why is it that that cools the body of water? Well, in order to evaporate, to go out into the gas phase, a particle has to escape, because that's the difference between a liquid and a gas, right? It's the same exact type of particles, just the spacing is different. In a liquid, they're spaced very close together, very much space between them in a gas phase. Well, what you were talking about, surface tension is important here, because water molecules are stickier than nonpolar molecules would be. They form hydrogen bonds between themselves, kind of keeping them cohered, hooked together. Not permanently, of course, just very, very small forces, but it's more than zero. To go off on its own, a water molecule that evaporates has to escape those hydrogen bonds. And which ones of those, that population of water molecules, which ones are the most likely to be able to escape? The fastest ones, exactly. So by evaporating, what you're really doing is eliminating the fastest particles in that liquid. And when you eliminate the fastest particles, what happens to the average speed of the ones left behind? It goes down, right? Just like when you reduce the brightest students in a class, the mean goes down, right? So that's why it cools you. Very, very effective. And that's why it's really necessary to keep you alive, because otherwise you'll overheat. So that's why this is a component of obligatory... Well, I'm sorry, sweating isn't obligatory. Transpiration is. But sweating is a way to enhance that water loss and therefore do an even better job of reducing the temperature. In any case, it's a water loss. So as good as it does you thermostatically, it's bad hydrostatically, unless you're replenishing water to allow you to continue to sweat. Here it just shows you what's happening compartmentally. Sweat is mostly water, but it also contains solutes, including urea, which is why your skin is also an excretory organ. It gets rid of some urea as well and other things. Anyway, it's mostly water, though. That water comes from the water that's in blood, specifically plasma of blood. So the gland itself is made up of an epithelium, like glands in general are. They are vascularized, and so water moves from the plasma of the blood in the capillaries into the cell of the epithelium. That's a change of one compartment already, right? And then it gets secreted into the lumen of the sweat gland, so now it's outside the body, really. Still on the body, but it's not in any of the compartments, really. It evaporates, well, the liquid water gets delivered through the duct onto the surface of the skin, where it's right in contact with the wind, and that's where it evaporates. So that's officially off the body at that point. Well, what does that mean for the blood? Of course, that's going to reduce the blood volume, because you're removing water from that to produce the sweat. And so It's a good thing that all the compartments are connected osmotically, because you don't want that blood volume to remain low. Or it's not just the volume goes low. When you lose the water, the blood osmolarity goes up. Both of those have their problems. So that actually causes the fact that the osmolarity of the blood goes up by removing the water causes water to come in osmotically into the blood from the interstitium. So you're now removing water from the interstitium. Well, that water that's removed from the interstitium then needs to be replaced osmotically. And where does that water come from? The intracellular fluid of the cells of the tissues of the body. So there's a lot of change of compartment. Water's going between these compartments all the time. I've run out of time now.